Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I would like to introduce my guest co-host, who's back with us today, Dr. Amir Barzan. He's one of our chief resident physicians at UNC Family Medicine, and he's filling in for Adam today. Thanks for being with us, Amir.
Of course, Christy. This is a great honor, and I'm really glad to be back here again.
On our show today, we'll be talking with Sarah Kovac, author and motivational speaker, about overcoming adversity as part of our series on medicine, faith, and miracles.
Sarah has a very great story to tell, and it's going to be a wonderful topic to discuss, so I hope you guys can stay forward to that.
But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about arthritis and overweight people having more pain.
Going to talk about home blood pressure monitoring and how it could likely save us some money in the long run.
That your genes or your genetic makeup might help you pick your friends, not pick your nose, but pick your friends.
And how statin use may actually stop when terminal illnesses are occurring and what that happens and what the outcomes may be in our patient populations.
Okay, so first let's talk about arthritis. So super common to have chronic joint disease called osteoarthritis.
And what we know is that overweight and obese people with arthritis in their knees tend to actually report more pain than slimmer people with chronic joint disease.
And in this particular study, they showed that people, even with the same amount of arthritis-related damage to the joints, so you can look by x-ray and there are different ways you can tell how much damage is happening in the joints. And even people who had the same amount of damage and progression of their arthritis, if you look at that group, the heavier people or overweight people had more pain compared with the thinner people, even though their damage was the same.
And the article was published by Dr. Weiss in the journal Rheumatology, who had the idea thinking that BMI, or body mass index, was tied with pain with arthritis. So she looked at about 5,000 people and found that people who were more heavy set or had a higher BMI actually had more pain. And her conclusion was that decreasing your body weight could actually lessen your pain, which may in turn make people more likely to take on a more physical activity, resulting in even more weight loss.
Yeah, this is a tricky thing, Amir. As we counsel our patients, you know, people come in with knee pain a lot of times from their osteoarthritis, and you say, well, you know, it's a hard conversation to say, you know, we really got to work on weight loss. And it's like, well, I can't exercise. My knees hurt. And so that is always a tricky thing of finding ways to lose weight, even when like going out and running is probably not going to be super comfortable. But exercise in the pool and other work with a physical therapist to get ideas of how you can lose weight with a nutritionist is really important.
Absolutely.
Let's go to our next research that matters.
So our next research that matters actually talks about home blood pressure monitoring for hypertension or high blood pressure and how that likely saves us money in the long run.
So this was a study that followed almost 34,000 people with two different health insurance plans. One of them helped cover a high blood pressure or a blood pressure monitor for the home, and the other one didn't.
And what the study looked at was whether or not having a blood pressure monitor at home actually helped save money for the insurance plans in the long run. And what it showed is that in the first year, anywhere between $33 to $166 per person was saved, and over $415 to $1,300 over 10 years was saved per person that actually had a blood pressure monitoring at home.
And so, I mean, intuitively, we know this as physicians. It's so helpful if people can monitor their blood pressure at home, can bring in some readings of how it's running outside the clinic. And that way, we can make some decisions that day about whether we need to adjust medicines or not. And it turns out that it also saves money. And so this is just sort of a plea to the insurance companies to cover that for our patients.
Yeah, hopefully this will make some changes in the long run so we can have a better idea of how to address such a common medical issue.
Yeah, if you have high blood pressure, bring in some of those readings to your doctor. It really helps. Okay, let's talk about your genes may help pick your friends.
This is a really fascinating study that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that showed that DNA might play a big role in deciding who you actually hang out with.
I think this is just really interesting. It's not very actionable, but apparently when you look at DNA and study genes, as these geneticists or specialists in this area did, that if you look at it, we have more DNA in common with the people that we pick as friends than we do with strangers.
Which is really fascinating. And this study showed that basically we have about a 1% match in genes with our friends. And 1% may not sound like a lot, but that's actually as much related as we are to our fourth cousins or people who we are great, great, great grandparents with.
So it's some... there's some link there between us like somehow seeking out or being compatible with as friends, people who have the similar genetic makeup, and somehow we managed then to select them as friends as likely as people who tend to pick people who resemble our kin, our fourth cousins. That's just, I don't know, that's interesting to me.
We hope
it is to you. I don't know what you can do about that, but it'll be so interesting as we continue to study to try to figure out what these things really mean.
Absolutely.
Your genes might help pick your friends. What is it? You can pick your friends, you can pick your nose, but you can't pick your friend's nose.
That's right. Always pick your friend's nose. And in our last research that matters, we're going to talk about statin use. And statins are a very common class of medications that we use to help people with high cholesterol.
And super common. We've talked about it on the show so many times. But this was a study really looking to see what happens. This was 381 patients whose estimated life expectancy was 7 months. And half of them were randomized to continue taking their statin. And the other, so it's given for cholesterol or for heart attack prevention, that sort of thing. And others were randomized to stop taking that medicine. And they were monitored for up to a year.
And the study, which was published in JAMA, or the Journal of American Medical Association, showed that death rates within 60 days were similar within both groups, but patients who quit the statins had a significant improvement in quality of life, feelings of being well supported, and then they also sought and saved money over those who didn't discontinue the medication.
It's a tricky thing because sometimes people, when you start taking off medicines as they get older, feel like, oh, well, my doctor's pulling things off because they don't care about me anymore or something like that. But in fact, it's really a very reasonable idea that saves money. And in this case, you know, they had improvements in quality of life, which is very important in those end of life times, and didn't have any differences on the other health outcomes.
Absolutely.
I think that's good news.
Something important to talk to your physician about if you have a loved one that you're helping take care of that's in their end of their life.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We've had a chance to talk about statin use and maybe stopping that when you're at the end of life.
About how genes may actually help pick your friends that you hang out with.
About how home blood pressure monitoring likely saves money.
And how overweight patients with osteoarthritis actually have more pain compared to those that are normal weight.
So we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Sarah Kovac, author and motivational speaker, about overcoming adversity as part of our series on medicine, faith, and miracles. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzin.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzin. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Sarah Kovac, author and motivational speaker, about overcoming adversity as part of our series on medicine, faith, and miracles.
Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. Tell us, you were born with a condition and you've written a book about your life experience. Tell us a little bit about the condition you were born with and how that's affected you.
Okay, it's called arthrogryposis multiplex congenita, but it is a lot easier to say AMC. That's what most of us call it. A lot easier to spell, too.
Okay, say it one more time.
Arthrogryposis multiplex congenita.
Okay, what does that mean?
It just means two or more joints in the body are born with contractures. They're stiff in place and underdeveloped. With me, it affects me from basically the base of my neck out to the tips of my fingers, but it can show up in about 400 different ways. So I've run into other people with AMC on the street, and I had no idea that we even shared that condition because it looks so different from one person to the next.
And how common is this?
It occurs in about 1 in 3,000 live births. My particular version of it is not genetic, and that occurs about 1 in 10,000.
Wow, so not very common, but still something that we should probably see at some point in our lives.
Yes, and I mean, I think it is good, especially for medical professionals, to hear about it, because a lot of people that have children with AMC, they find that their doctors don't really know what they're dealing with, and that can be a really scary thing for a parent.
Absolutely, and that actually brings me to a great point, Sarah. I knew very little about the process of AMC before I had a patient who was actually one of my first patients that I had in the Family Medicine Center at UNC who had AMC, and he was telling me about his journey. And one of the things that struck me was he was going through a lot of life changes, including getting married and going through that whole process. And at the very beginning of your book, you mentioned one of your biggest life changes about undergoing having a child. And can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how your condition influenced that and what that was like for you?
Well, the having a child was pretty painful, I'll tell you that much. Becoming a mother was equally painful on a few different levels as it is for many women, as far as, you kind of come to terms with seeing yourself in a new way. But it was difficult for me because I had changed one diaper. I'd never held an infant baby. I'd never had any experience with babies until I actually had one that I had to care for. And because my AMC affects my arms, it was really tricky learning how to carry him and get him in and out of a crib and things like that. And so it was just, it was a real learning experience. And I mean, my experience is that if you really need to do something, you'll find a way to do it. And if you can't figure out a way to do it, then there's probably a way to get around doing it. So we just had to be patient, and luckily newborn babies, they're pretty patient in that they're not going to run off if you're trying to figure something out. So my firstborn, he was sort of my guinea pig, and we didn't have any bad things ever happen. I never dropped him, never had any issues, but sometimes it was slow going as I figured it out.
Well, and now you've had two babies, right?
Right, yes.
Congratulations.
My daughter is 10 months old.
10 months old. Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit more about what prompted you to write the book, and then we can maybe get into some of the concepts that you've written about so eloquently.
Oh, thank you. Well, what prompted me to write the book was I had been blogging for a while, and I entered this contest with other bloggers and ended up winning a scholarship to go to a speakers and writers conference in North Carolina, actually.
Cool.
And when I got there, I ended up having a meeting with a literary agent, and I didn't realize what I was getting into. Anyway, I walked in and pretended like I knew what I was talking about, and she ended up signing me. So then I ended up in contract with a publisher, and then I actually had to write the darn book. So
you had to write it.
So that's how I ended up writing it. but, you know, once I started going, I would be up at about 5 in the morning so I could have some time to myself before my son would wake up, and take about an hour or two every morning and work on it bit by bit. I type with my toes, so I can't do too much at a time because it's kind of taxing on my back. So I just took little bits at a time, but I got it done ahead of schedule.
So that in itself, I have a friend who's an author, and writing her book and editing and just everything that goes into it is so very difficult. And yet you also have the challenge of typing with your toes.
Right. Luckily, I mean, I've been doing it for long enough that it's not so much of an issue. Not something I give much thought to these days, but I also am smart enough to know that I probably can't continue sitting like this for lengths of time. You know, 20 years from now, I'm going to be feeling that. And, so I'm looking into other ways. I've thought about trying the voice dictation. It's difficult changing the way you think in order to get the words out how you want it the first time when you're saying it, rather than being able to type and edit as you go. But
it's just so fascinating to hear the way that you discuss all of the issues that have surrounded you with such humility, because one of the points that you mentioned in your book is that you're sharing your story because you want others to know that pain and issues don't have to kind of win out and have the last word in the discussion. What was the greatest source of what you were going through, and how did you find the strength and perseverance to continue doing what you do on a daily basis?
Well, I have to say my parents have really instilled some good things in me. I mean, the idea that I could quit just doesn't really cross my mind. They didn't raise me that way, and they always really supported, you know, they didn't push me, but they didn't hold me back either. They just kind of let me do what I needed to do, and that has really developed a strong sense of independence in me.
And you mentioned in your one of your first chapters the discussion about your mom when she was a very young teenager, mm-hmm. and having you and how that shaped your life.
Sure. Yeah. She wasn't sure she was ready to be a mom. And, you know, as I went back and I actually interviewed her for my book for that first chapter, because I wanted to make sure I got it right. And just the things she was expressing about, you know, she just wasn't sure if she had what it took. And when I came along, you know, she felt so unsure of herself and felt like she was in over her head. And her experiences, you know, mine mirrored hers pretty closely. And her being so strong and her dealing with what she dealt with, I think, is a huge motivator for me to make it through the things I deal with. And also, I have a faith in God, and I have a very close support family at my church, and that is no small part of what keeps me going and what keeps me encouraged.
Well, that was actually what I wanted to ask you about, how your faith and coming to faith. I don't know if that happened at a young age or as you were an adult, but how that had really influenced your journey.
I remember being young and leaving church and going home and telling my mom I thought that, because I was raised at the time and in a church where there was a big emphasis on healing, and it was sort of confusing for me. And I left, and I thought, well, I told my mom, you know, maybe God doesn't heal me because He wants to use me to help a whole lot of other people. And I was maybe 6 years old, and that has kind of stuck with me. That is a bigger reward and a bigger healing thing for me than I could ever receive physically. So I can't
insightful
complain.
as a mere 6 year old to have that kind of insight into God and His kingdom.
Well, yeah, I was in church at 2, and then I was in from 4. I was at a Christian school. I was just surrounded by, you know, those kind of thoughts and those kind of people. So
you talk a lot about faith in your book. I wonder, what do you recommend or what do you say to people who may be suffering from pain or from disability who don't have that spiritual aspect or don't have a faith in God?
That's hard. Like I said, having that faith in my life has been such a huge part of it. And I think that whether you believe in God or not, He's still on your side, and He's still putting people in your path to help you. And, you know, I think it's good if at some point you can recognize that's Him and, you know, give Him the credit that He's due. But there's somebody on your side, whether you believe it or not, and He'll guide you whether you realize it or not.
That's beautiful.
It really is. And Sarah, we have to take a short break, but we're really excited to hear more. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Sarah Kovac, about her book and her success as a motivational speaker about overcoming adversity as our part of our series on medicine, faith, and miracles. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzin.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzin. We've had the pleasure to be talking with Sarah Kovac, who is the author of Incapable Arms, Living with a Life Embraced by Grace, and a motivational speaker about overcoming adversity as our part of our series on medicine, faith, and miracles. Sarah, you've given us a great insight into your condition called arthrogryposis multiplex congenita, or AMC, and we've really enjoyed hearing about it so far, and thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Now, and you described to us that your arms, because of this condition when you were born, are not perhaps as long and able to do things that other people might take for granted, like typing with their fingers, mm-hmm. and you type with your toes. But one of the things you talk about a little bit is your experience in a working environment. Tell us a little bit about what that was like for you and what you took away from it.
Well, I think growing up as a person with a disability, you know, when you're a child, your parents are there to advocate for you, and they are there to look, or they should be, you know, there to look out for how to help you function best in the world. And then you go out and you get a job, and they're not there anymore. And it was a difficult transition for me, especially I'm sort of an introvert, and I, in a group, I tend to be pretty soft-spoken. It's difficult for me to stand up and say, hey, I need this. So I learned very quickly that in the professional world, if I need something, I need to speak up and say it, because I can't expect, you know, those people, they've probably never seen AMC before. They probably have no idea what a person who types with their feet needs in order to do it well. And there were a lot of people that didn't understand. There was a lot of staring, but it was a real exercise for me to become more gracious and more outspoken about what I needed.
And one of the things that you had mentioned so eloquently in your book is this feeling that you had whenever you were going through this process of typing with your toes, and someone came by and mentioned, you know, take your feet off the table, and how you had this recollection of moments in the past part of your life about having to use your feet to eat and use them as we would our hands, and how you almost felt ashamed of those situations, but you always persevered. How do you describe that to someone? I can't even imagine going through that experience on a daily basis.
Well, I'm not going to lie. It makes me kind of want to stay home or get the tucked away booth at the restaurant. But, it's one of those things where you feel shame over it, and you really shouldn't, because there's nothing that you can do about it. But I almost felt like every time I went in public, I wanted to sit everybody there down and say, this is arthrogryposis. This is what it means. This is how it works. My feet are very clean. Please don't be disturbed. You know, I just wished I could have, you know, gotten out a megaphone and just educated all of them and moved on. But it's not that easy. I would get, you know, people. Yeah, the waitress came by my table one time and slapped my foot off of it. She didn't realize that I was eating with my feet, and situations like that where I'm so shocked that I don't even know what to say. And then 5 minutes later, I think of this really awesome comeback that I should have said and wish that I had. But it's embarrassing, and then I feel embarrassed that I'm even embarrassed, because there's nothing I can do about it, and it wasn't intentional on their part. So,
well, what do you, I mean, if you could, and you say you wish you could just educate them on the loudspeaker really quick. Well, you're on the radio right now. What do you think that people who see someone with a disability that's, you know, that's a more, we've all have faults and struggles and various things that are easier to hide, but people who have physical disabilities that are more visible, what do you recommend to people? Of should they say something to you? Should they not? Should they, once they see it, sometimes people might look twice of like, is that what I just saw? Because they don't normally see somebody eating with their feet. Like, what do you tell people of how to do that kindly, or to sort of recover if they have looked twice at, you know,
well, first let me say that I understand, and I have done the double take with other people. You know, just because I have a disability doesn't mean that somebody else's disability doesn't catch my eye, and I feel awkward. As a matter of fact, when I was a child, I hated to be around other people with disabilities because I felt so uncomfortable. So, you know, don't think that I don't understand what you're feeling. And as a matter of fact, when I'm first meeting people, I try not to look them too much in the face, because I kind of know they're going to double take, and I don't want to catch them in the double take because it's embarrassing for everybody. So I give them a second to kind of collect themselves. But, I mean, and I wish there was a catch-all answer to that question, but the fact is that everybody with a disability is different. I prefer, because I'm an introvert, I prefer not to be just approached, you know, by a stranger on the street and ask questions. I prefer that over you staring at me. So if the options are you're staring at me or you come ask me questions, then come ask me questions. Other people, on the other hand, with disabilities, you know, they love to have people come up and ask them questions. So I think, honestly, the best thing that you can do is pay attention. And if, you know, if that person has their eyes down to the ground and kind of the go away stamped on their forehead, then don't ask them questions.
Yeah.
If they're looking up and seem to be welcoming you into a conversation, then, you know, take that step and speak to them. But we're all different people, so there's no good answer to that, unfortunately.
It's kind and thoughtful of you to have developed this element to kind of look away for a second, to kind of put that person at ease. That says a lot about you and your character, that you would be that kind of someone else's experience.
Well, thank you. I know that, like I said, I know how that feels, and I've been that person that was staring, and I don't think that it's ever a hostile thing. And so, you know, I try to be gracious about it, and there's no reason for me to be uncomfortable about it. It happens all the time, so.
And with everything that you've done and everything that you've gone through, now you've published this book and you're still serving as a motivational speaker, do you find yourself sometimes being put in a more center approach about AMC because of your experiences than others, and especially with being an introvert? Is that something that's difficult for you to overcome?
It's not as difficult because I feel like I'm sort of an introvert that I flip a switch. You know, when I stand up on a stage, I'm opening myself up to that. You know, I'm opening myself up to questions. If I'm shopping at the grocery store and I'm just trying to mind my own business, that's a different thing. But I do find that, you know, if anybody hears anything about AMC, like, I don't know if you saw American Idol, there was a girl with AMC on there, and everybody was posting her videos to my Facebook wall, and, you know, like, I should be friends with her or something. And so, yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of the people in my circle, I'm the only person with AMC that they know. So, of course, you know, I'm going to be kind of their go-to girl on that one.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It used to bother me, but I've grown up a little bit, and I've realized that if I can use that for good, then I will.
Yeah, well, you certainly are using it for good.
Thank you.
And you write in a way that is applicable not just to people who have your condition, the AMC, but who have other disabilities or other insecurities. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, as you advise people or reflect and encourage people to face our own struggles and personal challenges, what do you recommend for people? How should we overcome our personal fears and insecurities? That's a big question. But,
yeah, that's huge.
Right. But, you know, where does it start?
And I feel like my answer over time has changed as I've grown. Where I'm at right now, kind of, and even the little blurb on the website says, your greatest weakness may be your greatest strength. And that's what I've found, is that, for so long I wanted to pretend like I didn't have any weaknesses or, quote, overcome, you know, this disability that I have to the point that it would not even be an issue in my life. But that's not reality. And it came to the point where I realized that, okay, I can't pretend like this is not here, and I can't make it go away, so I'm just going to let it work for me. You know, I'm going to allow it to be part of who I am. And it was that moment that I started actually feeling like I had a purpose and actually doing things that mattered, when I started accepting myself with all my flaws.
That's very moving, and thank you for sharing that with us. And before we wrap up, one more time, we've mentioned your book before, but do you mind telling us again the name and the title of your book and also your website, so if others want to learn more about your condition or more about your story, they can do so?
Absolutely. My book is In Capable Arms, Living a Life Embraced by Grace. And my website is Sarah Kovac, SARAHKOVAC.com.
Well, Sarah, we are so grateful that you've taken this time with us and that you have, you know, learned what you have through life and that you're using that for good. And just appreciate that perspective and for you sharing that with us and our listeners today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored.
We've been talking with Sarah Kovac, author and motivational speaker, about overcoming adversity as part of our series on medicine, faith, and miracles. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health.
You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzan. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, Amir and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on upcoming shows, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And now we'll have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, read us our very first house call question of the day.
I have depression and anxiety and take medication for both. Recently, I feel like my memory is not very good either. My psychiatrist said my anxiety meds are causing my memory problem and suggests that I stop taking them and take more of my depression medication. I'm still depressed, so maybe this makes sense. What do you think?
Sometimes we find that in older people who think they have dementia, or family members are thinking they have memory problems, and it turns out that it's depression, and you treat the depression and their thinking becomes more clearly. So it's similar to that with at any age, where it could be related to the depression itself. It also could be related to the anxiety pills. It's hard to know which ones, but I wonder if you're on these benzodiazepines like Ativan or Valium or Klonopin or one of those things that can definitely make you more tired and altered.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the hard parts in this situation is it's almost one of those what came first, the chicken or the egg kind of scenarios, is if you treat your depression better, do you improve your cognition and your memory, or is it maybe a side effect from one of these other medications? And that's why the important thing is to kind of continue to watch this over a period of time and see how you do.
Let's have our next house call question.
We recently took our father to the hospital with a headache, fever, and neck pain. The doctor told us that he had a sinus infection and neck spasms. They gave him antibiotics and sent us home. The next day, after getting much worse, we took him to a different ER. There, they told us he had meningitis. We were furious with the first hospital. How could they have made such a horrible mistake?
Oh, I'm so sorry that that happened to your father, that he had meningitis, and then to have that sort of question about whether that was an error or whether it just hadn't declared itself yet. It's easy for us to sort of look back and blame and point fingers, but it's also, I mean, what's most important is that your dad got the treatment that he needed. But let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, it's hard for ER doctors, I'm married to one, to be really thoughtful and careful, but not over, I mean, you can't like do a lumbar puncture or a spinal tap on every person who comes in with a headache, for example.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we do through our residency training is we get a chance to rotate through different departments. And being down in the emergency room and seeing what life like an emergency room physician is, it's very difficult when you're having to look at a lot of patients to make sure that you're ruling out the big things, but also taking care of situations. And in medicine in general, there's many times where we think that something could be causing the issues or the symptoms that you're having, but it could also be caused by a multitude of illnesses, some that we may not even have a good understanding of. So it is very difficult to say, was it a sinus infection that caused this? And sometimes sinus infections actually do end up being the causes of meningitis leading through the tracts. And so it's hard to say, maybe he did have a sinus infection that presented itself as getting worse over time. But the important thing is that you did exactly what I hope the doctor told you in the ER to do, which is watch him for signs and see if he gets worse, and if he gets worse, to come back. And that's one of our things as physicians that we always want to educate our patients on, is if symptoms get worse and people aren't getting better, then reevaluation by a physician or another physician is always a good idea.
Absolutely. That's good advice. And we're really, really glad to hear that he got the treatment that he needed. Let's take our next house call.
I am 64 and have swelling on my left testicle for 2 weeks now. It doesn't really hurt, but it's definitely swollen and has extra fluid in the top part of it. What could this be?
Something called a hydrocele. And maybe we'll ask our health sciences librarians to put up maybe the anatomy of the testicle and some of these terms. But it could be something called a hydrocele, where you get fluid inside there. It could be what's called an epididymal cyst, where you get like a little fluid-filled cyst on the epididymis, which is the top part of this little gland that sits on top of the testicle. What else, Amir?
It could also be a varicocele, which sometimes looks like swelling or engorgement of the veins around the testicle, or a spermatocele, which is sometimes a similar type situation where there's fluid filled within a cyst that's in around the area. But, you know, sometimes it could be something more serious. Like if there's something that's been there that's been growing for a while, it could be a mass that could be possibly a cancer. Although at your age group, that would be kind of unlikely to have a new testicular cancer in your 60s.
But, I mean, this is the kind of thing you want to get checked out. And a lot of times a doctor can assess it with a light shining or can know by feeling it what it probably is. You can also, the doctor might order an ultrasound to sort of get a better picture of what that is and help you go from there. Sometimes these things sort of go away on their own. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people can get so much fluid built up in their scrotum that they need to have it drained. There are lots of different ways this can go. We certainly hope that your course is easy and it just goes away.
That's right.
All right. Thank you for sharing that. And let's have our last house call question.
My wife's mom was just diagnosed with ovarian cancer. My wife and I would like me to test for a CA125 test, but my new doctor didn't think that was a great idea. What do you think?
Whether or not your wife should be tested. And the CA125 is a tumor marker that we see sometimes in ovarian cancer. The hard part about the CA125 marker is that other conditions of the ovary, such as ovarian cysts that have ruptured or enlargement of the ovaries, can cause that to be elevated. So the test might not actually give us a good answer onto what's going on. And there's been many guidelines that have been published in terms of cancer prevention and whether or not to screen. And this is actually one of the ones that the U.S. Preventative Task Force has recommended us not doing a general screening in the population for, because the test isn't 100% conclusive.
Well, and it's not just that it's not conclusive, but we get the results, and it can be a marker that's associated with a bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. And so then if it's normal, well, it doesn't mean that you don't have some type of cancer. If it's elevated, nobody knows then what would be the next step. What do you do about that? And so maybe that could then cause harm with more anxiety or harm with more tests that, you know, doing CAT scans and all that has radiation in it, and that can, you know, increase your risk of getting cancer. So it's very complicated. But right now, there's no recommendation for getting a routine CA125 on the general population. And with you, I don't think that this thing happening in your family will directly affect your risk, because it's on your wife's side. But we're sorry that you had to go through all that. And I think that the discussion about your wife is an important one. I've been following this carefully because my husband's aunt passed away from ovarian cancer. And there's a lot of that sort of breast ovarian in that side of the family. And I have a little girl. So, like, I want to know what to do to make sure we look after her. But at this point, there is no general screening that's effective for ovarian cancer. There will be one day, but we just hadn't figured that out yet. Thank you for your questions, and thank you for sharing your stories with us and for giving us a chance to give you our thoughts about those.
Absolutely. And so today on House Calls, we've had a chance to talk about depression and anxiety and whether or not a diagnosis led to meningitis in the hospital.
And about testing that may or may not be recommended, and sort of how to proceed with that if you want to have something done that's not recommended. And then about swelling on a testicle and what kinds of things that could be. We had some good ones today, Amir.
Sure did.
Thanks for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. And we want you to share your questions and stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook. Get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download at the App Store.
And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Sarah Kovac. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Amir Barzin.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.